M.C. Richards wrote a poem for her longtime friend on a very special occasion. It's titled, For John Cage on His 75th Birthday. Dear John Cage, it is already dusk, and the cows are not yet in. Already dawn, are not yet out. Listen. It sounds ever thus, the breathing. 40 years ago, you touched down at our landing, young planets inwardly orbiting. Tira-lira-loo. Our first words were a courtship. Tira-lira, day in and day out. Shall I tell you the secret of our mystery? You are a preacher, and I am a missionary. We make love for justice and delight, kindliness, laughter, and rage. Macrobiotic eros, you nourish the ends of the earth in ever new beginnings. The cows, John, the cows are banging their udders like soft cymbals, and the milkers are playing the teats like bell ropes, tugging and letting go. The music. My God, the music. For John Cage on his 75th birthday, a poem by M.C. Richards. And we're told she began this poem here in northeastern Pennsylvania while on the way to attending the birthday celebration in Cage's honor. In the piece, she refers to their first meeting 40 years before, when he touched down, as she puts it. That would have been at Black Mountain College outside Asheville, North Carolina, where M.C. Richards was teaching literature and learning pottery and translating Antonin Artaud and living in community with others. And this poem for John Cage on his 75th birthday, which was begun here when M.C. Richards lived in Susquehanna County on Endless Mountain Farm, making pots and writing poems and so much more. That poem is now hanging on a gallery wall at Marywood University in Scranton in an exhibition titled M.C. Richards, Centering Life and Art 100 Years, now through October 26th. A show celebrating the many contributions of potter, poet, painter, author, translator, and educator Mary Caroline Richards on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of her birth. And it is curated by Julia Connor and Alice Sibrel, and organized by the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center. M.C. Richards was born in Idaho in 1916, and she grew up in Portland, Oregon. She graduated from Reed College and received her Ph.D. from the University of California at Berkeley. In 1945, she joined the faculty at Black Mountain College, where she taught writing, translated plays, danced, studied pottery, and founded the Black Mountain Review. She was one of Black Mountain College's most popular faculty members in the late 1940s, and she later wrote, "I have no criticism of Black Mountain. It was an entirely transforming, maturing, and inspiring experience." While at Black Mountain College, M.C. Richards played an essential role in maintaining community balance in the wake of Joseph and Annie Albers' resignation and the rise of Charles Olson as the college's leader during the 1950s. She was among those who participated in the 1952 happening at BMC titled Theater Piece No. 1, a multimedia experimental performance conceived by John Cage and David Tudor, said to be the first event of its kind. M.C. Richards, Centering Life and Art 100 Years, includes work from the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center collection and from various lenders. Highlights for this exhibition include works in clay made from her Black Mountain College years up to the 1990s, paintings, poems, broadsides, and typescripts from Black Mountain College and after, photographs, and ephemera. The exhibition is accompanied by a digital catalog with contributions from Paulus Berenson, Julia Connor, Matthew Fox, among others. There will be a gallery talk tomorrow, Wednesday, September 21st, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, by Robert Schweitzer, curator of the Maslow Collection at Marywood, who selected works from that collection to complement the M.C. Richards show, pieces by artists who were either teachers or students at Black Mountain College during the 1940s and 50s, including Robert Motherwell, who taught at Black Mountain during the summer of 1951. Robert Schweitzer's talk is titled The Pivotal Moment of Black Mountain College and Contemporary Art, and he stopped in at the WVIA studios to share some of his insights.
This academic school year starts with this exhibition that comes from Black Mountain College, their museum. And the exhibition pertains to works by M.C. Richards. We did an exhibition also not that long ago, back in March of 2015, from M.C. Richards' experience living in the Endless Mountains and working there, primarily as a potter. When she went to Black Mountain, she went there as a teacher of literature and ended up being a translator and involved with Cage. But she had many more activities, and then she really started potting at that time too, doing ceramic work. And she did it while she was teaching. She came back again, and Karen Cairns was there at that time, and she studied with her. So the relationship was ongoing from 45 when she first went to Black Mountain until she finally left with a group of them. I think it was in 52, and the group included John Cage and Tudor and all these others. I think Merce Cunningham was with them and the rest, and they went back into New York. The school was slowly breaking up. It went from 33 to 57, but I would say by 53, 54, it started to break up. A lot of the main people were leaving, and by 57 they were both out of finances and faculty, so the school closed. So it was a very short period of time for a university's existence or a college's existence, but probably one of the most dynamic, incredible creative environment where so many things took place, so many people gathered, so many people shared ideas, so many people worked in an environment that was unlike any other at that time and still pretty much unique for the teaching experience.
We sometimes associate in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina, an influence from the Bauhaus.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the convergence there is really interesting when you think about it. Here's a Professor Rice and Theodore Dreiser, and they left. They were basically kicked out of the school, Rollins University, I think it was, or college in Florida, and they were not happy with the teaching environment. They were more into Dewey. So you have this Dewey philosophy, John Dewey, his philosophy on education, and it would break down the order, literally the order that existed in existing universities and teaching programs. So they're leaving and planning this in 1933, this opening for Black Mountain. Another interesting thing, Philip Johnson, who was the architect, who was the first curator of architecture at MoMA, had been to Bauhaus before, so he already knew people from Bauhaus. Now, how they knew him, I'm not sure, but he heard of the starting of this university, and he was the one who named and suggested that the Alpers come, Joseph and Annie Alpers, who were at the Bauhaus. Well, the Bauhaus, prior to this, started in the, I think it was 1919 or 1916, by Walter Gropius, another architect. That's probably how, you know, Johnson had traveled there, because he was going to meet a colleague at this very exciting university, which was interested in what was called the total work. You know, it was one where the arts were not broken down into categories in such a way that you lived in isolation, but you were always in a discussion back and forth to find the creative process that could produce the new world, the avant-garde, or whatever you want to call it at the time, and still call it today. So this was already in existence, so they had an experience. The Alpers already knew what it was like to work and teach in that kind of environment, and then they were brought here, and Rice had said, okay, they'll be our first teachers in the arts. So he headed up the art department there, taught people like Rauschenberg and I believe Twombly. And there were so many people that came through. It's hard to remember exactly who was there at the time teaching. I mean, people talk about Buckminster Fuller being there quite a bit, but he was really there just a couple of summers in 48, 49. And I think afterwards he came back, obviously, because he was there for the first performance piece, the first happening, as we call it today, that now John Cage had initiated in 1952. And you look at all these things that are coming together. I mean, you have the Bauhaus, you have Dewey, you have dissatisfied teachers being kicked out of one school. Let's start something that's different. And they wanted a non-hierarchical school. They wanted a school where both teachers and students were learning, not just, you know, I will deposit the information to you, you know, as a student, and you learn from me strictly what I have to give to you. No, that was not the model that they strove for at all. And because of that, it really brought very creative people to that place. They wanted to be part of this, M.C. Richards being one of those, who I think graduated in California, went to Chicago for a brief period, and she didn't like the teaching there. She heard about this. She and her husband went to Black Mountain. So it was this wonderful kind of black hole, maybe, that was sucking in all these really good people. And when they were there, they lived that kind of community. The faculty, the students, everybody did cleaning up. They did, there weren't any chores or duties that were so subdivided that you didn't feel like you were part of it. You had to be part of the whole. So that sense of, and later on, M.C. Richards uses the term wholeness in her work. And it really comes from this kind of experience of being part of a whole, being part of a, in my days in college, which came a little later, you know, we talked about the commune, you know, where these things could happen. And I visited a number of them where these kind of shared responsibilities had taken place during the late 60s and 70s. So this was that moment, though, that preceded much of what I was part of. We're talking, to me, the very important years, at least certainly in the visual arts, would have been from at least 47, 48 through to 52 or 53. So again, a very brief period of time. But during that period of time, you have Rauschenberg doing the white paintings, which were actually part of the happening that happened in 52. You have Buckminster Fuller coming, meeting with Snelson, who is in the Mazo collection. I should mention that in the Mazo Gallery, I put out work by those artists that have some affiliation with Black Mountain that we have in the collection. So you have Robert Motherwell, and you have Rauschenberg, you have Snelson. It might be nice to have a piece of sculpture of Snelson. We have a 380-degree image of Wall Street by him, a very long, long image. And we have Dorothea Rockburn and Peter Haley. We have there only because of his reference to Alpers. He wasn't really at Black Mountain, but I put him in because the visual reference is there. And it's that kind of exhibition that links somewhat, but all of the works in there come after the Black Mountain period. So we don't have anything that really was of that time. The masses didn't collect during that time. So the richness, though, of it, and it helps in the discussion that I'll have on the 21st at 3:00 in the gallery, where I'm not going to spend as much time talking about M.C. Richards as I am about what the impact really was. How was this moment so important, and as brief a moment as it could be? You know, there's this argument back and forth between Buckminster Fuller and Snelson as to who really came up with the idea for the geodesic dome. If they really looked at it, the geodesic dome was actually built 20 years earlier in Germany by a German, but he had no patent in the United States, and Buckminster Fuller ended up getting the patent, which bothered Snelson. He created a new term for it. Snelson had his own term for it. But Snelson was playing with this in his sculpture early on. But again, this kind of dialogue taking place back and forth, and the irony of saying, you know, teacher, student, both learning at the same time. I mean, Buckminster Fuller even said something to him later on about, well, I'm the one everybody knows. So at that time, they didn't know Snelson.
So it was that creative ferment. And we always associate, if we know anything about Black Mountain, with tension. There were stresses internally.
Some of the stresses were early on, I would say, probably the greater part when Rice was there and he created an environment. Like, he had the original idea and concept, but somehow, because they were governed in a non-hierarchical way, they asked him to leave because they thought he was distraction. He was, his temperament and other things weren't working well. So he only survived from 33 to 40 as the director, a very short period. And then others came in after. Charles Olson came in the early 50s as
the
a poet. And you have Robert Creeley, who was there at that time. M.C. Richards was also obviously teaching literature and writing. She produced, they give the credit to now Creeley for starting the Black Mountain Review, but essentially Richards did the first edition, let's say, the first printing of the Black Mountain Review, but then it didn't go any further. So she did one, and they picked it up a few years later in the 50s. And they added, she did it basically focusing on what they were doing at Black Mountain. What Creeley and Olson were doing was looking at poetry in a larger sense. So they had Ginsberg in there. They had people like this that were important for the time, but not necessarily directly associated with Black Mountain. I mean, here's this environment. I remember being in college years later, and when Hampshire College was started, and I think of Hampshire as being sort of that next generation, or the attempt to do something intentionally to create a space that was going to be much more experimental, that was going to be much more open and not driven by the same principles that existed in Amherst and the others nearby, even though they were the ones who wanted to start it because they thought this kind of experimental environment was very healthy and they should explore what it would mean. I was ready to go. I mean, that was the time we heard about it, and students were all excited. Wow, this is the kind of environment we want to be in order to think, create, act, speak, and have a dialogue with our professors. So, again, this is that spin-off from what happened at Black Mountain, that sense of interdisciplinary, at one level, discussion when you talk about the academic side, but just on the personal side, the kind of sharing of expertise and knowledge and benefits, so that M.C. Richards did the French translations for Cage of Artaud and Satie and these things, where they could produce things that weren't being produced in the country before. They were only in the French, and her you know, specialty was French, so she could do these kind of translations. And they ended up, you know, moving off together, as I said, to New York, to Stony Point, and they had started another center there for now expressing a whole range of things, because the Potters went, and as well as the dancers and the rest. I mean, this is where Merce Cunningham formed his troupe, was at Black Mountain. So you look at what could have taken place in such a brief period of time that's had a lasting impact in so many ways across the board.
You may have seen the story about the current reconstruction of Paul Taylor's dance Tracer that was done in 1962, but it had set and costumes by Robert Rauschenberg.
Oh, he collaborated with Cage and Cunningham for quite some time afterwards, and was in dances too. I mean, he performed as well as did the physical works that were present within this kind of movement within space. I mean, when you think of Cage and Rauschenberg, this coincidence of time is not really a coincidence, but they were all basically studying Zen Buddhism too. There were these other philosophies that were happening that they wanted to explore. So Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which came out of this period of time, coincides with the white canvas that Rauschenberg did. And when you look at this kind of openness to think differently, to think what are not only the possibilities, but what does something, in Cage's terms, chance, have to do with art? Because they're bringing art closer to life. Life is not this sort of, I'm looking at something and it's detached and separate, but even the white canvas was perceived as something upon which you cast something. It was your tabula rasa, so that it invited you to participate in a way, and the 4 minutes and 33 seconds enabled sound. Whatever happened at that time became the work, so you can't repeat it. It's all based on chance, and that whole sense of how chance played into the nature of the process for many other artists later on was pivotal for that time. So again, that's coming back to why this particular moment is important to discuss and to rethink. And I would wish that some of those things that they considered in terms of the teaching process would be applied today in more university settings. Because I think for my generation, again, when I look back at Black Mountain, I think, well, how was that replicated in Soho during the early period of Soho, where artists lived together in lofts next to each other? They did creative things. I mean, you had the dancers, you had Trish Brown, you had Rauschenberg, you had Philip Glass, you had all these people that were in a very similar environment, sometimes right next to each other, sometimes just sharing the same space, sharing their ideas, integrating these kind of thoughts. And then even later on, with the Brooklyn Academy of Music during the Next Wave series, they also brought many of these artists back and explored that whole sense of what can happen as happened in the first. It was more refined afterwards. Certainly that first theater piece of Cage in 52 was totally experimental. It wasn't long after where the person who sort of coined the term happening, Alan Capro, started doing his, but that was towards the later part of the 50s. And he also studied with Cage in New York later on. So these are kind of continuations from that period, and continuations that just bloomed, and other people took them on and did these incredible works that, well, for some maybe not as incredible, but for me quite incredible, that persist till today in different ways, slightly refined, a lot of the dance still relates to that kind of experience at that time. You had these gatherings at BAM where, again, Rauschenberg might have done the set and Cage and Cunningham are doing music and the rest, but not sitting down and maybe discussing it, but saying, let's see what happens when we put our ideas together in a physical place. And what, again, back to the chance, let's see what happens. And that kind of uncertainty is, to me, a very creative moment, because you don't feel you have to control it to make it happen in a particular way, but things sort of move through the space and they become real in real time. And it's not something you can say, oh, I saw this before in this way or this way. It wasn't stylized to that extent.
And again, that is connected with the way life unfolds.
Exactly. And that's why the happenings were much of that. Now, they seemed kind of zany to most people, that, you know, fill a room with tires and crawl through them or something like that, and that's your happening, or create a space with these, you know, ephemeral walls and you're breaking through them and moving. Whatever it might be, that this is more Capro or ice. You know, you build a wall of ice and it melts. But it's part of real time. It's in real time. It isn't something that may last. In most cases, a happening doesn't last. It can only be documented or filmed possibly and the like. But it's never going to be the exact same. It can't be. So it has to rely on the moment of now. And that's part of what they were exploring at that time, in various ways, very new to it. It's interesting that Alpers, who you know, Rauschenberg said was so important to him in terms of a discipline, but Alpers, when you look at his work, is very, very straight-laced, let's say, you know, and he's color theory. He's dealing with color all along. So what is the most known piece that Rauschenberg does out of that is a white canvas. But at the same time, he's saying that what brought him to that moment really came from his experience with Alpers. So personally, we can't go into that too deeply and say just what were all those things that made it happen. And we know Rauschenberg afterwards was much more known for the collage, for bringing more things to fill in that space, to fill in the white space. But for him to go through that moment of creating it first and then moving on to the next, which was to do the combines and to do other things, for him personally, that was a very pivotal moment.
And all of the trials and terrors of the world that's going on at that period as well.
The Bauhaus closed in 1933 because, you know, Hitler and the Nazis said, you can't do this anymore. This is not appropriate to the Germany we see as a future. So I'd love to see a book written, and maybe there has been. I have never seen it or had it in my hands. But the impact of the war in terms of the migration of artists and writers and others, between Bertolt Brecht, between the Surrealists, many of them went to Mexico, but what kind of impact they had there and what kind of dialogue they had with Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo and the others who were there at that time. Likewise, what was happening, because Gropius came over eventually, and the architect. So you had this dispersal of people that actually were in a very creative moment in Germany at the time, and that was destroyed by Hitler, and as he destroyed so many other things. But what it also did was it energized other communities in other parts of the world in ways that they may not have been, not to say that it could ever be a justification for that, but to recognize at least that there was something that came out of it in the art world that enabled other people to have a dialogue in a much broader way and in communities that probably would have been isolated otherwise, because we didn't have Facebook in those days.
And so getting back to the exhibit that's at Marywood, the focus being M.C. Richards, and she was so much not only about pottery, but painting as well.
And there's a great deal of ephemera. There are some of the books, the poetry, and the rest. So there's a lot to offer that gives you some insight into what she was as both as a woman, as an artist, and that she didn't stick to just one discipline. I mean, again, it's such a great example of what Black Mountain was about, that it enabled someone to grow in so many ways, that they shared. It isn't like in departments where you don't even know the person, you know, in the classroom next to you, let alone teaching in a particular way. Or did you go and take those courses, or did you bother to cross over? No, it was a very open environment where these things happened. And she is sort of the epitome of that kind of openness and exchange on the part of the individual that took advantage of all these wonderful resources and people and ideas and allowed them to blossom in her own way. So her poetry continued, as well as her pottery. And her poetry is sometimes as magical as the work. I mean, there's that one poem, I believe this is the poem, and it goes, hands, birds, and that's it. So it's the amount of time between the two words, how that sets up what's happening in your head as you respond to one word, moving to the next one. And is that now hand in flight? Is it bird? And, you know, there are all these things. It's not tied together with specific language to say, okay, I'm talking about this in relationship to this. So the relationship part is the open space, like the 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It gives you that opportunity for your thoughts to move to that next word, which then sends you off from there. So it's just this, to me, I can't find anything better. That's my kind of aesthetic. That's my kind of creative experience, that I'm in it. You know, I have to be in it. I can't be just observing it and saying, I like that, or I don't like that. That's not sufficient sometimes for me. There are times I certainly say that. I mean, I'm not going to be inside of a Caravaggio painting, nor would I necessarily want to be. Certainly not in his life. So, you know, things like that I can appreciate. I can certainly respect and acknowledge, you know, how incredible these other works are. But in our time right now, we also have that other opportunity. Art shouldn't be a closing in of options. It should be an opening up of options. And my sense of how they opened up during that period was monumental compared to what was happening before that period. And that would have been more the, you know, the white box, let's look at a pretty piece on the wall, as opposed to all the other things that are possible. And this offers some bit of a window into what that was like, and hopefully it might offer something to the visitor to feel and experience likewise, hopefully.
Robert Schweitzer, curator of the Maslow Collection at Marywood University in Scranton, speaking with us in anticipation of his gallery talk titled The Pivotal Moment of Black Mountain College and Contemporary Art, to be offered tomorrow afternoon at 3:00 in connection with the current exhibition at the Mahady Gallery at Marywood. The exhibition is titled M.C. Richards, Centering Life and Art 100 Years, celebrating her many contributions as a potter, poet, painter, author, translator, and educator. With clay works, paintings, poems, broadsides, photographs, typescripts, ephemera, and more, the show is curated by Julia Connor and Alice Sibrell, and organized by the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center in Asheville, North Carolina, and it runs now through October 26th. Robert Schweitzer has curated an exhibition that complements the M.C. Richards Show, Black Mountain College, Artists from the Maslow Collection, featuring pieces from the collection by artists who were either teachers or students at Black Mountain College, and those artists include Robert Motherwell and Robert Rauschenberg. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu. Marywood had a wonderful exhibition in 2015 that really celebrated M.C. Richards and Paulus Berenson and the time they spent living and working in Susquehanna County here. This exhibition focuses more on M.C.'s life overall and a wide range of pottery and paintings and poems and more. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu. You can see the show, M.C. Richards, Centering Life and Art 100 Years, now through October 26th at Marywood University. And you can attend a free gallery talk tomorrow afternoon at 3:00. And that's by Robert Schweitzer, our guest today on Art Scene.